Welcome to the Writer Dojo with your host, Steve Diamond.
Not dead yet.
And Larry Correa.
They were all in love with dying. They were drinking from a fountain that was pouring like an avalanche coming down the mountain.
Today's episode, On Location.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the Writer Dojo. Glad to have you back with us. How you doing today, Larry?
Good. Every now and then I like to see Steve's reaction when he finds whatever weird thing I picked for the beginning of the episode.
Yeah, Jane's Addiction, huh?
Is it? No, it's...
No. Pepper. No, that's...
Pepper.
Is it? No.
Oh, I don't remember now. I heard it on the radio on the way over.
The Bloodhound Gang. It's either Bloodhound Gang or
I don't think it's Bloodhound Gang. No, Bloodhound Gang did The Lap Dance Is Always Better When the Stripper's Crying.
Oh.
Which is still the greatest song.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. We diverge.
Regardless, I knew the lyric. I was reciting the lyric with him. I just can't remember who actually said that one. Now I'm going to have to look it up. All right. Today, Larry, you and I were talking before we started recording about a potential topic for this episode. And I think it's pretty fresh on both our minds because, one, I just wrote a story for and just did all the edits and everything for the Down These Mean Streets anthology. And the whole theme of that anthology is kind of the third part in a trilogy, in an unofficial, official, whatever, trilogy of noir anthologies coming out from Bane.
Yeah, edited by me and Casey Ezell. Right.
The first one was called Noir Fatale. Mm-hmm. Super excellent.
The theme was the femme fatale.
The femme fatale. And I have a story in there that's basically the Christoph origin story, from the Age of Raven series that Larry and I write together. The second one was called No Game for Knights.
Yep.
A lot of incredibly good authors in that story.
The Hard-Boiled Detective.
Yeah,
the
I know Chris Rocchio has a freaking awesome story in
Rocchio's
that one.
Was really good.
And we're going to have Chris Rocchio on the show here in a
Gutter
couple weeks.
Gutter Ballet, I think, is the title.
First of all, freaking rad title.
We're gonna have an episode on wordsmithing with Rocchio, because he is...
So good.
He's the best wordsmith author working right now.
He's so good.
Yeah.
And it doesn't come across as wordsmithing. It just comes natural to him.
No, it's not pretentious. He's not trying hard to do it.
He's just good.
He just writes poetry.
So that was the second one. The third one, Down These Mean Streets. I have a story in that one, and it's my first werewolf cop story. But mm-hmm. The whole theme of that anthology is the city.
Yeah.
Right?
It's where the femme fatales and the hard-boiled detectives interact.
Right. Right. And then, so what we were kind of talking about was how oftentimes in fiction, especially when you're writing contemporary fiction, or even, I guess you could say even historical fiction, it's really important that where you're setting the location of the story, that it has that distinct flavor, that location feels like what that location is in real life.
Yeah, and this was interesting. So this is, like I said, fresh on my mind because I edited. I want to say we have 15 stories in here, 14 stories.
It's like 140,000 words.
It's a big anthology.
Yeah.
And I'd say about half of them were fictional cities where they were either science fiction. Like mine, I used my Lost Planet Homicide City.
Yeah, I love points. You told me the idea of that one. I'm not going to spoil it. We're not going to spoil it for everyone.
Yeah, I actually wrote.
But it's so cool.
Yeah, I wrote
it's such
from
a
the
good
perspective
idea.
Of the city.
It's such a good idea. Such a good idea.
It was fun. And so I used 5 points, you know, the city from Lost Planet Homicide. And we have other ones that are fictional cities. You know, we had, or like Casey's story takes place on Mars. You know, Rob Hampson's was a space station. And so basically it's a bunch of different things. However, a bunch of them were real places.
Yeah, like mine is set in Sacramento.
Yeah, which actually I mentioned that in my intro because I talk about like exotic locales like Sacramento. I even said that. Well, because people, I mean, it's funny because we had another one set in Albuquerque.
Oh, cool.
Which is excellent. It was an excellent story.
Nice.
And so, but the thing is, we wanted to talk today about using these real places, and I've done this a lot because I write urban fantasy primarily with Monster Hunter, borrowing from real life places
and
getting them right and getting them wrong and the dangers of using places, especially places you have never been. And also, it's almost impossible for a writer to go all the places that we set books.
There's no way. There's no freaking way.
No, it's kind of a logistical impossibility and a monetary, fiscal impossibility.
Well,
for a lot
and
of
let's
us.
Be real. Some of the places that I've written stories in, that you've written stories in, I don't want to go there.
I don't want to go to Afghanistan.
I really don't want to go to communist China today.
Oh, yeah. No, Steve's writing a thing right now in
it's set in China. It's set in northern China, kind of along the, it used to be part of Russia. Okay. And it's specifically set in a town or in a, I guess it's a town, a city of Harbin, outside of Harbin. And in Harbin, China, it used to be Russian. There's like a Russian church there, like full on Russian architecture. And there was this whole treaty and stuff in the 1900s. And so anyway, whole point is making sure that you get these things right in terms of flavor, geography, weather. I mean, even the sights, the smells, the sounds.
The people. The culture.
It's really important. Now, in the context of the anthology that you just edited and the one that I wrote a story for, specifically in detective fiction, the city is almost always like a character in the story.
Indeed. That is kind of a feature.
That's the theme.
Well, that's one of the things we were hitting, because as a noir anthology, that's a common theme, is the city as a character. And most of the stories in this really did hit the city as a character.
You have to. You really have to.
Yeah. Like the Albuquerque. Oh, my gosh. Like, wait till, I can't wait for you guys to read this, because it's like weird fantasy Albuquerque after dark.
Nice.
And I've only been to Albuquerque 3 times, and it felt spot on to me, but Casey used to live there. She was stationed there. And Casey just loved it.
Oh, nice.
You know, so yes, there are, because she knows it well, you know, and actually I have my brother-in-law's assistant district attorney there.
Oh,
okay. I was actually going to send it to him, especially because it's got all this weird underbelly of the city stuff going on. I just want to see his reaction, because like he's probably prosecuted half the people in this. No, it's using real cities and real places. Like you actually spent a lot of time in Sacramento, though.
I lived there.
Yeah, you lived in Sacramento growing up in a suburb.
I lived there from 1990 to almost 2004.
Well, and your dad was a police chief.
My dad was the police chief of a suburb of Sacramento called Rancho Cordova. I went to high school there. My wife went to college there. Like, I know Sacramento. I've been there.
Yeah,
I've eaten in the restaurants in the bad parts of town that you shouldn't really go to at night.
Well, that's the best tacos.
Well, it was legitimately it is.
No, there's a thing. The best tacos are where the most murders happen.
Oh yeah, for sure. I'm pretty sure that's
why that is.
This isn't like that. Those like statistical like bizarre correlations that don't actually mean anything. No, this is direct. This is direct.
No, and I'm not saying this is a negative. I seek those out. That's the best. I think it's because if they're still open in that neighborhood.
Oh, you know everyone loves it.
Yeah.
So it's really interesting. I know, look, in a lot of cop fiction, a lot of stuff, there's this temptation to always set the story in a city that is super widely recognized. That's why you see so much stuff in New York City.
And Los Angeles.
Los Angeles.
Chicago's probably
Chicago,
third.
And maybe Miami.
Miami's, if they want sunnier background, that's Miami. Yeah,
if you want people in Hawaiian shirts, then you're going to go down there. Right? Yeah. You're going to have it in Miami.
Yeah. I think it depends on the vibe. But honestly, you notice though, those are like the big four of like,
yeah.
Also not of that, but also of urban fantasy.
Oh, Chicago. I mean, Dresden Files is in Chicago.
Yeah.
A lot of stuff is in LA. A lot of stuff's New York.
Yeah, it's interesting because a lot of this stuff, well, a lot of like the Hollywood stuff tends to be LA or New York because guess where they film? Either that or it's in Toronto and they say it's LA or New York.
Well, I was going to say they're almost always filming up in Vancouver.
Or it's Atlanta and they say it's.
Yeah.
If you've been to Atlanta and you've been to Los Angeles, you know those two do not look alike at all, but, you know, whatever.
But there are so many other really interesting cities around the country and around the world that you can draw from. That's why I chose Sacramento for my werewolf cop story, and actually the sequel to Residue is set in Sacramento as well. It's called Parasite. It comes out later this year. It was coming out in September. I'm pretty sure it's still coming out in September, but there's been a good weird development in terms of that whole series. But anyway, point is, when you live in a city for a long time, you start to see how things work in that city, and you start to see what the seasons are. You start to know kind of the depressed areas. If you just visit a city once, oftentimes you're like in a hotel.
Yeah.
You know, and you don't really get a flavor for
how it sounds. You saw the airport.
Yeah, you see the airport.
And the hotel.
And like you know, an Uber to your hotel.
And the conference center for whatever mm-hmm. event it is you're going there.
But when you live in a city, you start to see how things interact with each other. You see how the weather really, really has a dramatic impact, not just on the city itself, but on the people.
Yeah.
And that was something that I really tried to bring out in my story for this. It's called A Devil's Bargain. But the whole thing of this is, and I guess this is my question for you, Larry, how can we start as writers? How can we make these aspects of cities feel legitimate? And how can we personalize them?
Well, I take it beyond cities too. I was just thinking like locations in general.
Sure.
Well, my thing is, okay, so there's a lot of places I've never been, but I've set stuff there. And sometimes I get it right, sometimes I get it wrong. I'm only human. But what I'm going to try to do is I'm going to try to learn everything I can about the area, especially if there's like interesting little tidbits or factoids or cool things. And also not that I'm like reading out of a tourist guide. I want to talk to people from there. And like, well, I've talked about alpha readers before, but if I'm doing a specific location as a character, I will always try to find people who are from there to read it. And they'll tell me if I'm right or wrong. Especially if it's something that's set in a different time period. And it's easy to screw stuff up. So if you can find somebody who actually lived there during that, you get a better vibe. Now, there's some things that are just universal human things, and people are the same everywhere you go at some fundamental level. And that's one of the things that, like, doesn't even matter the fantasy world you create, the people are still relatable. But when we're writing about real-life stuff, if you get it wrong culturally, if you get it wrong vibe, you're going to hear about it. Because you got readers there.
Yep.
Or you got readers who've been there, and it doesn't feel right. I know he talked about Jim Butcher of Chicago. Jim's not from Chicago. Jim gets yelled at. I know Jim gets yelled at once in a while by people from there because he screws up geography. You know, that's going to happen.
Yeah.
That's going to happen. Google Earth is honestly your friend. Google Earth is great as a writer. Fantastic.
Yep.
Okay, but the example I use is Monster Hunter Alpha, set in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, which is a peculiar place. I have never been there, never been there. And I wrote this story. I wrote this book. And it's a really good book. And in fact, some of the reviews of this book from the UP are Larry Correa must have grew up here or spent summers here or something, because you could tell he really knows us. And he really, like, no, I actually don't. I've never been there. The closest I've been is like Detroit, which is a million miles away. Right?
Again, I've been in the airport.
Yeah, I mean, I've been to like Minneapolis and Detroit. I've been around those cities. I've never been to the UP, so I don't know. I've never.
It's too cold there.
Well, not by my standards. Not compared to where I live now. It's way worse. It's way colder. But the thing is, what did I do have? So I had research. I had the ability to read, you know, and investigate and look up cool stuff. And then my secret weapon was two guys that were friends of mine, Mike Coopery,
yep,
and Steve Loma, who I worked with in the gun business. These two dudes had both lived and grown up in the UP. And they were my guys that I used. I would be like, hey, guys, read this. And they came back. I go, oh, yeah, well, nah, this would be more like this. And I had a bunch of old Finns. If you know that area, there's a lot of old Finnish people. Both of those guys that I was talking about are Finnish descent. And I had an old Finn character who was kind of based upon stories these guys talked about growing up. I mean, like Steve, his dad was like the town doctor.
Yeah.
You know, small town doctor. And in Calumet, Michigan. So I had a fictional town. That way, one nice thing about using a fictional town in a real area, I can screw up the specifics of this one town, and that's okay.
Yep.
So even though it's based on Calumet, I've never been to Calumet. So if I don't get Calumet just right, that's okay. This is Copper Lake, entirely different town.
Totally different place.
Totally different place.
Yeah. And I've done that too. You know, I mean, Residue is just a made up town up kind of, you know, Eureka, kind of in the Eureka area of Northern California.
Yeah. Which Redwood-Z. But if you've been up there, like I growing up, I used to go to Ferndale.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And up in that area. And you get kind of the vibe of it.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it feels right.
Well, and you know, I've grown up in small towns.
Yeah.
I grew up in small towns. I know how they feel. And I know what the economy looks like in small towns like that.
Yeah. One of the best pieces of writing I ever did was the beginning of Hard Magic, about the old dairy farmers.
Yeah.
And that was actually one of the best, like, pure bits of writing that I've ever done. And why? I grew up in El Nido, California.
Yep.
And where was that? El Nido, California. And I come from old Portuguese dairy farmer. My grandpa was an old Portuguese dairy farmer. My dad is a Portuguese dairy farmer. And that's who I grew up with. And so talk about the 1930s stuff. I just had to move it back in time a little bit, yeah, you know, just, to like when my grandpa was a kid.
So just make it dustier.
Make it dustier. And, that was almost autobiographical because that's a place and a culture that I know like the back of my hand.
Right.
And so I can nail that vibe. So I think that's a great tool in a writer toolbox to be able to draw on. Like you grew up in Sacramento. It's a place most people haven't been, but you can nail the vibe as the city of Sacramento, you know, and what it feels like. And then guys like me who grew up south of you, but we went there on every school trip to go to
Sutter's
Mill.
Sutter's Mill or Old Town Sac.
Yeah, everybody who grew up where I went, that's our field trips were to Steve's home area.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, but, you know, the vibe feels right.
Yeah.
You know, you can – well, we're up against a break here in a second, and we'll talk about this some more when we come back because there's some really interesting things that you can do.
All right.
Using these locations.
Okay. So we'll take a quick break. We come back. Let's continue on that. Let's talk about it. We'll be right back.
A young wizard's apprentice sent on a perilous mission. A band of mercenaries paid a fortune in gold to protect him. Their mission? Deliver a secret artifact to a king halfway across the world. And from the outset, they are being hunted. Herman P. Hunter presents The Wizard's Stone. Available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, the Apple Store, and more. Buy it today.
All right, everybody. Welcome back. Okay. So before the break, Larry, we were talking about using real locations and stuff. And you were about to launch into a thought. You're about to launch into kind of what you can do to, like, little tips and tricks that you can take to actually make these places feel real.
It's weaponized personal knowledge.
Yeah.
If you've got...
I like that phrase, by the way. That's cool.
I don't know. I just like... Well, I was thinking of this is when I was editing this this recent anthology. I got a story from Laurel K. Hamilton. Laurel's awesome.
She's freaking rad.
She did a vampire story set in the Florida Keys, which is not a normal place for a vampire story. It's a very sunshiny, nice place.
Yeah.
And but the thing is, though, you could tell that Laurel knows the area. She understands the culture of the area, and the way she writes her story, you can feel it. And that got me thinking about, like, so when I did Monster Hunter, I set it in Alabama, rural Alabama.
Yeah.
Why did I set it in Alabama? At that point in my life, I had basically lived in three places, and I knew three places well. I knew California, but it's the San Joaquin Valley of California, which is flat and empty with just cows, you know, and then I knew Utah really well. I had gone to college at Utah State University. I lived in Utah. I worked in Utah. Utah just didn't seem like the best place for setting secretive monster-killing fiction, you know? But then I lived in Alabama, and I love Alabama. And everybody from Alabama, if I say, hey, there is a haunted monster thing down the road, around the corner, down in the forest, that's not hard to believe.
Yeah, they won't blink.
No, because if you've been there, you know what I'm saying. It's an awesome place. I love it. And so when I was writing Monster Hunter, of the three places that I knew the best, Alabama was the one that had the best vibe for what I was trying to accomplish. And plus, culturally, I wanted to write Southerners that were heroes as opposed to the usual stereotypes that get lumped into TV and movies.
Yeah.
And that bugged me at a personal level. And so I wanted to have, like, heroic Southerners. So it made sense. So that's why Monster Hunter is set in Alabama. But weaponized personal knowledge. So having been all over that state, there was Mississippi, there's things like I had the scene with Natchee Bottom. In real life, that's Hatchee Bottom. But I had been stuck in Hatchee Bottom during a really bad rainstorm and a flash flood. And it is a dark place. It is a scary place. It's the kind of place where the locals have a lot of legends.
Sure.
You know, so people who live in that area, like, you know, Walnut, Mississippi or whatever, they'll tell you stories.
Yeah.
Honestly, so I'm writing something that's kind of a scary thing. So they turned into a fictionalized version.
So they have those stories. And when you're sitting there in the middle of a rain, like a crazy rainstorm, flash flood.
Oh, yeah, we were stuck.
And there's the lights are out sometimes, whatever. Was it that hard for you to believe that there wasn't some craziness going on in those shadows.
No, yeah. So for me to be able to write crazy monster fiction set in that location, not a problem.
Right.
Not a problem. And then down a bit on the southern, you know, I did other areas. I moved stuff around very liberally with geography,
yeah, of
and,
course.
And tweaked stuff. I took one particular giant weird building in southern Tennessee and moved it to the central Alabama. You know, I could do stuff like that. But the thing is, culturally, I knew the people. It's funny because even then I still screwed up stuff because at one point I had somebody talk about giving directions and they referred to the road as or the highway as the something something as opposed to just the number, which I guess they pointed out that's not – they don't do that. That's a Western thing. I don't know. I'm a Westerner. I don't know. I'd even catch that I did that. But you know what? Yeah. It was – Julie was the one giving directions and she's been all over the country and all over the world, so I'll blame it on that. We're not perfect.
Seems plausible to me.
Yeah. But as I was saying, weaponized personalized knowledge, but there are certain authors who are really known for the locations as a character. And a lot of times it's because they have personal connection to it. They have knowledge of that. And sometimes they don't have knowledge of it, but they fake it. Like I said, Jim Butcher's not from Chicago.
Yeah.
But Jim writes a Chicago as a character in Dresden Files.
You know,
you can do it.
I remember when I was writing my story, The Gift, for the Monster Hunter anthology. And
great story, by the way.
Yeah, I set that in Mexico because I've lived in Mexico. You know, I lived in Sonora, Mexico. And one of the things you learn when you go over there, I lived in this little town called Guaymas, which is, it's a port town. It's right on the Gulf of California. It's a port town. It's very poor. It's very depressed. It's extremely Catholic. And I don't know, it's the location of it is bizarre. Like there's these really, it's really close to like this very mud and boggy, almost kind of subsequent port area. The main city, which is a port, and there's like some hills and stuff around it. And then a little bit further to the west is a very rich area. Like, this is where all the rich white dudes go and retire down there. It's called San Carlos. But every day I was down there, I lived there for about a year. Every day I remember walking by a church. It was a Catholic church. I remember walking by it. And there wasn't anything wrong with it. I never felt anything bad about it. It was just a nice Catholic church. But it left an impression on me. And if you know anything about Mexico, there is a lot of superstition there. There's a lot of religious superstition there. The line between supernatural and superstition is very, very blurry in a lot of Mexico. And so I thought, well, shoot, like I can use some random, I can fake some random city in the US or like kind of like you did what you were talking about with Alabama, I can lean in on some of this stuff and set a story in Mexico. And so there's a few locations that I talk about in Mexico, in Sonora. And this story is set in Guaymas. And so one, that church is in the story. It's right there.
Yeah, you just monstrified it.
I just monstrified it. I turned it into straight up Catholic horror. And then the ending of the story is in San Carlos. And so I talk about the roads there. I talk about, you know, the churches, the people, the superstition, the religion, the Catholicism that's all baked in, inherent within these people. When I mean baked in, it's baked in. Mm-hmm. Like it is in their skin. You know, it is in their blood.
I had you read my story that I did for Jonathan Mayberry where it was set in Sonora, Mexico.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
Oh man, I forgot about that.
Yeah, because I had a little dusty desert town.
Yeah.
And I had you read that to make sure.
Yeah.
I got the vibe right.
Yeah, you know, it's...
Even though everyone was dead.
Well, whatever.
It was a horror story.
So it's, like you said, weaponized personal experience.
Yeah.
There really is nothing quite like being able to draw on real experience, real places that you've been and lived, and being able to take them and twist them to the story purpose that you need.
So it's not necessary, but it definitely helps if you can.
Oh, it totally helps. But, I mean, look, I visited New Orleans. I love New Orleans.
Mm-hmm.
I visited there. And I'll probably set some stories there because, you know, like I went on one of those swamp tours there.
Yeah.
And it left, I mean, it was like a 3-hour tour.
Yeah. But you've only been there.
I've only been there once.
A few days.
Yeah. And, but yet it left an impact on me. And so I'm like, yeah, I know. I think I can get something here.
There's those moments where you're doing something that stick with you, and it's like either emotions or smells or sights or sounds or feel or whatever that just stick with you from different places. Even that is enough to build a scene off of, you know? And even if you haven't been to a place, like I said, like me in the UP, I've never been there. You fake it till you make it, and then call upon people who do know it to kind of nail it down. And we've talked about the bad side. There is a downside to this too. You get some people who get a little too in the weeds of their location, and they start like giving you directions everywhere they drive. You know what I mean? And I took the such and such to the such and such to the such and such. No one cares. Yeah. And they kind of skim that actually, because it just doesn't, outside of the tiny fraction of your readership that happens to live in that neighborhood, no one's going to care. So you want to drop a street name here and there, that's fine. But you see some of these where they go in the complete travelogue.
I'm not looking at a Rand McNally Atlas.
Yeah, no, that just doesn't feel right. It's like people aren't reading your book for GPS coordinates. You know what I mean?
For those of you who are under the age of 35, that's a map book.
Yeah, we're old. Hey, man, my first book tour was pre-GPS.
Ugh.
It was in Southern California, too, San Diego and L.A., driving Dave Wolverton's giant... Or Dave Farland, as you guys knew him, rest in peace, Dave, great guy. That was my first book tour, was driving his giant, I want to say it was a Lincoln town car. It was so stupidly huge. I was driving this thing through Los Angeles using paper maps to find bookstores.
Oh, jeez.
I tell you guys, GPS revolutionized book tour.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, it's awesome. No, it's like on the going places, getting the vibe. If you can afford to do it, do it. But a lot of writers, you know, that's not an option. Like a lot of people listening to this, they're aspiring authors. They can't go afford to, like they're setting a story in, you know, Paraguay. They can't afford to fly to Paraguay for a week to really get the vibe down. You know, that ain't going to happen.
I'm writing that story in China, right?
Yeah, you ain't going
to
China.
I can't afford to go to China right now. I'm still poor. And two, even if I could afford to go to China, probably not my destination of choice today.
Some of the crap that you have said, you ain't leaving China.
That's right. That's right. That's definitely
and
right.
And some of the people you've worked for, you ain't leaving China.
That's a really good point too.
Yeah, there's also that.
Yeah. So. Yeah, I think I'll stick to first world developed non-communist countries for a while.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I hope they... I'm not going to make any comments about Chengdu Worldcon. I look forward to that. I'm hilarious. Yeah. Will ensue.
I'm sure all the bots in attendance will be very enjoyable.
Yes, I'm sure the Ministry of State Security will have a fine time. So anyways, okay, so if you can't afford to go places, what I would recommend to people is get as close as you can. Learn what you can. I mean, not physically. So, I mean, if you can't afford to go there, that's fine. Do your research, do your homework, and then find people who are from there and your acquaintances. And sometimes ask yourself, why am I setting something here?
Right.
You know, there might not be a good reason to. And sometimes, you know, honestly, like some of the James Bond, you know, because James Bond will be like 8 different locations per movie.
Yeah.
You know? And it's because they can afford to do these cool shoots around the world. But some of the places they go to are places that, like, honestly, no one in America has ever even heard of.
No.
Like, he's gone to cities that, like, I'm a kind of a geography nerd. I'm the dude, when you get on the airplane, they have a little, on the back of the seat, you can play the little trivia game where you, like, and I'm like 99 for 100 on that thing, right, every time. I'm the guy that plays the stupid Google Earth game where they'll show you a picture somewhere and you guess where it is. I love that stuff. I love geography.
I'm too busy being terrified of flying.
Yeah, that's true. But this distracts me. But there's places where they set these stuff that, like, honestly, it doesn't really matter. It works for them. And they can get it wrong, too, with impunity, because it's James Bond, right? So it's all about the location being different and exotic and cool. And no one's expecting accuracy. Plus, James Bond isn't going to, like, where the normal people are. James Bond is going to, like, the secret casino.
He's too busy going to the moon. Yeah. To, like a space station.
Well, I think that is the one movie that they'd rather forget. But, honestly, I do think it's going to be Henry Cavill next. But, like, you know, I like Henry
Cavill. I hope so. I'll go with Henry Cavill. Gosh.
I would have took Idris Elba, but Idris is getting too old. Love Idris.
I don't think he's too old. I just saw the newest Luther movie. He still can do it.
Well, he's Idris Elba.
Yeah.
You could do that song, that's Idris Elba. Yo, Coffee Man. If you guys haven't watched that, look it up. It's a music video called I'm Idris Elba, and it's hilarious. All right, but anyways, location. I've set stuff in London. My knowledge of London is basically 4 days playing tourist.
Yeah, that's about the same for me, yeah.
You know, so I have a shallow knowledge of London. Yet when I wrote a scene in London for Monster Hunter Siege, what did I do? I wrote it from the perspective of a tourist.
Yeah, and you know, I think that that's a good thing. Look, one of the things that you said earlier is I think the very first question, and that's why are you setting it here?
Yeah. And honestly for that, because Monster Hunter Siege was one where he's bouncing around the world getting ready for this great big crazy mission. If I set the scene from the point of view character who also is lost and doesn't know his way around and has been in town for a couple days.
You get a lot of leeway.
A lot of slack. So I use specific places that I had actually been.
Well, and that's no different from some of the stuff that we've talked about earlier, Larry. And that's that as long as any scene that you're writing, it needs to be from the most interesting point of view.
Yep. We've talked about that many times.
And sometimes when you're going into a city, the most interesting point of view is the person that knows all the things. And I think we see that in detective fiction a lot because the detective knows that city. It's his or her city.
Yeah.
In fact, they often refer to it as, this is my city.
Well, they've always got
it's possessive.
And they always know where to go, who the contact is, who to talk to.
They know the CD club. They know the taco truck. They know the prosecutor.
They know the ambulance. They know the local crackhead.
They know everybody. But then there are the other stories, especially outside of the detective, you know,
the fish out of water story.
The fish out of water stories. And that's I think that that's one of the best ways to handle dealing with a city that you are not familiar with.
Cody, to be fair, the movie Taken, the classic Liam Neeson movie, they did that where he came in and he was fish out of water, but using his particular set of skills was immediately able to start cracking heads and working off of like what the clues he had. But it wasn't a location that it was his location.
No, and in fact, most of the places that he went to within the confines of that narrative are fairly generic.
Yeah. Well, and then it's stuff like, and then when you need to bring in a character that does know the place, like he had the French cop that he knew, you bring in the other character that has those connections. Mm-hmm. So you guys can work within the constraints of your knowledge and then do your homework after. Just my thing on locations is just tread carefully because the more you screw up a real life location, the more that's going to haunt you.
Oh, yeah.
Like you can screw up little things and get a pass, you know, like that, that's okay. But if you screw up cultural things, personality things, they're going to hate you for that. So honestly, it's one of those, I would say it's a balance of research, time, and then finding people with that weaponized firsthand knowledge.
One of the other things I'd like to mention too, Larry, is, and this is to piggyback off an earlier comment that you made that's just kind of been sticking in my head. When it came down to your travel log, your Atlas narrative, you know, it's like, oh, I took Highway 80 to the 215
to take and 17th Street to, you know, 28th Avenue. You know, no one cares, dude.
I think a lot of times when people do that, it's because they're only thinking of this city in terms of a map. They're thinking of it in terms of something that they looked up online.
That's true. And I'm talking about doing research. That is one of those things that's it's a trap you can fall into.
So, but when we talk about cities, like when we talk about noir type stuff, right? Oftentimes when you're characterizing the city, that's exactly what you're doing. You're making it a character. Okay. And when we talk about characters, we're talking about, and we're writing scenes from the point of view of these characters. What are we talking about? It's not just what they see. It's what they hear.
It's how they feel.
How they feel, what they smell, what things taste like.
How do the people talk? Yeah. What do they sound like?
Yeah. And if you can bring in, like, look, we have more than one sense, you know, everything that we do isn't just our eyeballs. We have a lot. We have multiple senses. And to really characterize a city and to kind of get away from the danger, so to speak, of just having it sound like an atlas run, you can, if you bring in more sights and smells and sounds and stuff, all of the different senses into it, it can lend a lot of authenticity, assuming you get it right.
Yeah. And this is something that you can borrow from to use in your fictional settings too. Like I talk about, like I had my city of 5 points. And so for those of you that haven't listened to Lost Planet Homicide, the
you
premise
should
is,
be.
It's really good. It's free on Audible. But the premise is it's a lost colony. So they weren't supposed to go to this planet. They wound up stuck here. Long story short, it's basically five mountain peaks. It's a mountain range, are the only inhabitable land on this entire planet. Everything else is under a sea of acid. Yeah. And acid clouds. So basically from 6,000 feet on up is where all mankind lives. And so they've basically hollowed out these five mountain peaks, and that's where they live. And I've set up, so each of the five mountain peaks is basically a sub-city. It's a neighborhood, if you will. It's a sub, you know, they're all part of the same city. And most of this is set in Zenith, which is the lowest mountain, which is actually backwards of the name. Yes, I did that on purpose.
Yeah.
But the way I set up Zenith is like every squalid slum bad part of town I've ever been to.
Yeah.
Like every wrong side of the tracks attitude. Because keep in mind, they're culturally, these is a colony planet, so people were drawn, actually the original million people on the ship, were, or half a million people on the ship 100 years ago, were picked for genetic and cultural diversity. They very specifically, because this is a colony world that's going to be off the land, they wanted a very broad selection, okay? And so basically people were lumped by their jobs, not by anything else. So it's a cultural goofy mismatch of everything you can think of. And I pick crazily from everything.
Oh, yeah.
And just lump them all into one place. Like the law enforcement is actually British. You know, like,
yeah.
All the structure of everything is like, because that was the constable originally was British and that's where that came from. But like, so I set this up. It's like basically a series of caverns and tunnels, and there are all these underground sectors on this acid planet. But it's basically, because this is the poor mountain, it goes everything from like the worst neighborhoods and trailer parks you've ever been in America to full-on Brazilian style shanty towns.
Yeah.
Okay? So it's that and everything in between. And so basically your upper class is like what we in America consider like poor, and the lower class is like bad.
Yeah.
And so, but that's how I set this one mountain up. And that's the city and the personality is. But the cool thing about that, by being able to draw from every place and culture, is I can do whatever I want and just hammer them all together and then ask, now what?
Right.
Like, how does this shake out?
And so I think the cool thing about that, and I did the same thing with a novella that is supposed to be releasing at some point this year, a fantasy town. Okay. And I took experiences of, you know, those alleys that I've walked through, you know, in London, or those really kind of sketchy places in Mexico that I walked around in that I probably had no real business walking around in. And you bring those feelings, that sense of claustrophobia, or the weird smells that assault you when you're walking down those streets, the way the people stare at you or don't stare at you. And you can bring all that stuff into fiction and into the cities that you're creating. So one, yeah. I mean, look, if you can go to an actual city that you're going to set a story in, cool. That's awesome.
Yeah. It's very helpful.
If you can't, you know, do the research, but if you decide to make up a city, draw on real life experiences to pull that
There's
in.
There's little things too. Like different cities and different cultures, personal space.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that like as Westerners, we kind of take for granted. And we go to a city like, say, New York, where that has very little personal space by American standards. And as Westerners, we get really uncomfortable there.
Yeah.
Like you get on the subway in New York, it bugs me. Like people talk about, you go to Central Park to get away from it all. I went to Central Park, the quietest part, I saw like 20,000 people in there.
Yeah.
Right? And so I come from a place where it's middle of nowhere, peaceful, quiet, different culture. But then I go to Paris, and I was at the Louvre, and at the time it was a bunch of Chinese and Indian tourists. No concept of personal space.
No. They are literally standing on your heels.
Which is weird because the Parisians were taken aback by how little personal space was taken for granted by the Indians and Chinese. And so it's one of those things, like, when you're writing something, just keep in mind that is kind of like, that's a cultural thing. So when I'm writing Son of the Black Sword, and I have the cultures divided into the 12 great houses, I've put these little things like that, like some places have less personal space than others.
Nice.
It's just a little thing, you know, and everybody's got their little cultural quirks. Like I had one group of, when you stand, you don't point your feet directly at somebody because that's insulting. Other places, like if you don't take your shoes off when you go into somebody's house, you're basically declaring war. Okay, so there's these little cultural things that everybody has, and we don't even notice our own because they're just so ingrained, which is what we do. As Westerners, we have a different concept of personal space and speech and the way we conduct ourselves with people that's different. I saw somebody once talk about the difference between East Coast, West Coast, United States, where it was East Coast was they were nice but mean, but the West Coast was nice but mean, or I can't remember how it was phrased, but basically what it was is Californians will be polite and just awful.
Yeah.
Whereas New Yorkers will be rude but nice, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And then that bears it out. Like, so even like the part of California I'm from is not what most people think of California. Where you're from in California is not.
No, it very much isn't.
When most people in the United States of America think of California, think of Los Angeles.
They think L.A. They think
or
L.A.
Or San Francisco. And, and that's what has colored the perception of California culture. My part of California, you could take us and drop us in Idaho and no one would bat an eye. It's completely normal. Except we probably had more meth. More cows, more meth. That's about it.
I had more gangs.
You had more gangs. And the thing is, you go to New York and people are very rude. They're very loud. But they're actually kind of cool for the most part. There are some jerky New Yorkers.
Well, yeah. I mean, that was like Boston, right? Yeah. You know, we went around and we were walking around Boston and the people are very abrupt. They're a little overly loud.
And they all don't talk like Donnie Wahlberg. Everybody thinks that that's a, quote, Boston accent. No, that's one neighborhood of Boston. Whether Southeast or whatever.
Yeah.
That's one neighborhood of Boston talks like that. The rest of Boston talks fairly normal.
Yeah.
You know?
And you know, they were all very nice.
But then when I go down to Alabama, people are like, you don't have an accent. It's like you pronounce every word like you a news anchor. I mean, I got that down there. And it's like, no, I'm just talking. This is how we talk where I'm from. But everybody's got these different little cultural quirks and oddities and the way they talk. It's like the old soda versus pop versus Coke.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If I order a Coke, I want literally a Coke. Yeah. You know, we drink soda. You say soda in a lot of America, they're going to look at you funny. Like, what are you talking about?
That's a very West Coast thing.
Yeah.
And that's where you and I grew up.
Yeah. Well, and it's like, as much we've talked on the show about overrated Quentin Tarantino, but the scene where Inglourious Basterds, where Germans count 1, 2, 3 on their fingers starting from their thumb.
Yep.
Whereas the English, they go with their pointer finger is number one and the thumb would be number 5.
Yep. Just they're fun little cultural distinctions, right? Yeah, I really like adding these little tiny things into stories and into cultures. I think about Servants of War a lot, and there's a lot of Russian in the Ilarian side of things.
We steal everything we can from Slavic cultures.
Yeah.
And my knowledge of that is very limited. And
well, that's why we have Nikki.
Oh yeah. Nikki is our born in, she's actually born in Lviv, I think. No, wait, Nikki's born in the Ukraine.
But you know, she's basically our Russian expert, right?
Well, yes.
Cause in real life, she's a Russian expert.
That's her real job.
And we run it by her, and I remember her comments coming back from her read-through of Servants of War. None of them were crazy, but it was a lot of little tiny things that I went, huh, that's really interesting and cool.
Yeah,
and so we start baking those little tiny things in. And to me, that's where it makes sense. It's the little
cultural
things.
Thing. And I actually used her for, because she is actually an expert on organized Russian organized crime
right.
for Krasnov when I wrote Monster Hunter Siege. And so she actually read that and gave me a whole bunch of feedback. And
Krasnov.
Yeah, well, it's the same thing. The reason I use Michael Rothman when I wrote, talk about like when they sent Monster Hunter to Israel.
Right.
You know, because he has been there and knows it and speaks Hebrew and understands that stuff. And so anytime you guys can draw upon, no, I would say, I would caution one thing is when you are drawing upon somebody's personal experiences, keep in mind that they have a personal bias.
That's very true.
Because if you are, like, if I wanted to write about, so if you were, if you wanted to write about, like, say, Provo, Utah, and you came to me and said, Larry, what's your opinion of Provo, Utah? It would be very negative.
So would mine.
Yeah, and Steve would be very negative.
Yeah, I went to BYU.
Yeah. And so the thing is, I didn't. I hated BYU. I went to Utah State. Go Aggies.
I didn't mind BYU as the college or anything. It's, but that town, I have a negative opinion of Provo itself because of the way it's set up.
Yeah, so it's one of those things where if you ask somebody who chooses to live in Provo, they'd probably give you an account.
Sure.
Whereas everybody else in Utah who lives outside of Provo would give you an entirely different account. So keep that in mind when you are getting your local experts to talk about cultures, that just like your point of view characters, they're gonna have an inherent bias.
Yep.
They're either gonna love something or they're gonna hate something. There's a lot of towns in Utah I'll talk trash about just because they played football against my son's team.
Yeah, that's fair.
Like, I'm sure Grantsville and GWAB are great places. In real, you know, but you know, there are mortal enemies, so.
Nah, forget those guys.
Well, plus we won like 55-3, so. I mean,
yeah, I mean, it was a game for about 10 seconds.
To be fair, they are pretty good against a normal school. They just couldn't play us. We're just too good.
Well, but go. Again, but local. Again, that's a cult. That's a very cultural attitude local based sports. Local thing.
If I'm writing, once again, I go back to Alabama.
Oh, if you're in the South, if you ain't talking about football, get out.
Oh yeah. High school football night, the town shuts down.
Oh, it's very Friday Night Lights.
Oh, it is. And everybody's there. The whole town's there.
Oh,
Texas.
Shoot.
There's places in Texas that way.
I lived for a very short time in Alabama. I don't remember any of it. I was.
Oh, when your dad was...
when my dad was MP.
Yep.
And so...
Fort McClellan.
Yeah, when Bear Bryant died, who was an old coach for them. Oh. It was like the state shut down.
Oh, guys, you got to understand, that's like the Pope died in Italy.
It, okay. Like, it shut down.
That's a big deal.
And so, a lot of times authors, a lot of times authors make the joke of, oh, it's the sports ball thing I don't care about. You might not, but the people that your characters interact with very well might.
Oh, yeah.
And you need to get in sports, actually, dude. Sports is religion. You need to get that crap right.
Well, I'm a sports dad, so I get it. You know, I'm a writer nerd.
I love sports.
Steve sports. Like a lot of, like, we talk about writer nerds. Steve is actually also a walking encyclopedia.
I love sports. I love sports.
And Steve's also the guy, he's the contender in every fantasy football league.
Yes, I am.
Because it combines his love of Dungeons and Dragons and accounting.
If only there was a job for this. Wait, there is. It's probably gambling. I don't want to do that.
No, but here's the thing, guys. Keep in mind your characters, once again, it's going to come back. So if your expert on that area is not a sports person, but it's Sports Town USA, hey, man, that's a part of the culture. And like if you're writing about that kind of thing and it's pertinent, you need to keep that in mind. There's different attitudes on everything from traffic, like how people drive, how people treat each other, courtesy, how they treat waitstaff is different around America. That's one that's blown my mind going to different places in America.
Well, and around the world too.
Well, once again, I'm a Westerner who it's very much a politeness thing. Like, I'm a good tipper, and I'm a polite to waitstaff. My wife worked as a hostess. I mean, you know, my kids have been my daughters have been waitresses. I mean, I get this, right? But I go to some places in America, Provo, yeah. And I see how people treat waitstaff, and I'm like, wow. I mean, so keep in mind, there's these little cultural things like that, you know. So just be careful when you're writing this kind of, try to get to know the people from there and what they're at. And some stereotypes do exist for a reason. Like, there's regional stereotypes. Those exist for a reason. And others are just crap, you know? And I know me and Steve know about this. We're recording this in Utah. Okay.
Yeah.
And like 90% of the stuff I see about like my culture in the rest of the media is just stupid and wrong.
Yeah.
And written by idiots.
Yeah. And anytime
we're used to it.
Yeah. Anytime anyone writes any fiction relating to the LDS Church.
Oh, frick.
We always just roll our eyes.
We're Mario Puzo.
Okay, all right?
Guys. Godfather. The guy that wrote The Godfather wrote a book. It was about the fourth K. It was about assassinating another imaginary Kennedy brother.
Yeah.
All right? And he had, like, the assassin was Mormon. And it was the dumbest, dumb, stupid crap I have ever read that literally every single fact, and the guy was from Utah, every fact he had in the book was incorrect. Like, literally every single thing was wrong.
Yes.
But it was about us, so it was okay. You can just write whatever you want. Right. He wrote The Godfather. He gets a pass. Guys, you're better than that. You know, do your homework, do your research. Like I am not Muslim, but if I'm writing about Dearborn, Michigan, and somebody who's Muslim in a Muslim community goes to a mosque, I owe it to my readers to do enough research to make sure I get my facts correct and I write this in a way that is believable and human.
Well, and to bring this all back to the topic at hand, which is writing on location, writing cities that live and breathe, the main thing is to make them feel like they're lived in. Make them feel like this is a legitimate city that has its own legitimate culture, its people, in its own experiences.
Original Star Wars versus the prequels.
Correct.
Yeah, perfect example.
Exactly. One has life and energy and soul, and the other one is a cash grab.
In front of a blue screen.
Correct.
Yep.
All right, that's all the time we have for you today. Hopefully you enjoyed the episode. If you didn't, well, screw you. If you did, awesome. If you have any other questions about this stuff.
Steve's channeling his inner New Yorker.
That's right. I meant that in the nicest way. If you have any questions, go ahead and shoot them our way. And again, our supporters, we answer those questions first. And if you want to be a supporter, you can do so for as little as 99 cents a month, all the way up to 10 bucks a month. Or if you want to come up with some other different deal, just email us and we'll take care of you. Again, this is the Writer Dojo. We appreciate you all. We'll see you on the next one.
Writer Dojo is Steve Diamond and Larry Correa. Produced by Jack Wilder and Bear and Hare Studios. Theme song, Word Mercenaries by Craig Nybo. New episodes come out every Wednesday wherever you stream your content. If you enjoyed this podcast, you can help support us by going to anchor.fm/writerdojo, by leaving a 5-star rating and review, and by helping to spread the word. To advertise on the Writer Dojo, email ads@writerdojo.com. All questions and comments can be emailed to questions@writerdojo.com.
You just monstrified it.
I monstrified it.